You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, while the future of President Trump's impeachment trial is uncertain, our guest says the whole process so far has been bogus. He'll tell us why and what he thinks Senate Republicans should do after last week's House impeachment vote. First, a new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism shows that about a third of Wisconsin's hospitals, 40 to be exact, are Catholic-run. That makes us one of the most heavily reliant states in terms of health care from Catholic hospitals. Those medical centers are governed by directives from U.S. Catholic bishops. While they provide services to people in low-income and rural areas, doctors sometimes have to deny or delay certain types of reproductive care, including abortions, contraception, and sterilization. That's been a source of controversy among people who don't subscribe to some of those beliefs. Parker Shore is a reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and a public policy fellow at the Capital Times. He worked on the center's story on reproductive care at Wisconsin's Catholic hospitals. Parker, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the services that these hospitals provide, you write in this piece that Wisconsin, compared to other states, is more dependent on Catholic hospitals.
Mm-hmm. That's right. The state is more has more Catholic hospitals than almost any other state. We have twice the national average. We have a third of our hospitals are Catholic and abide by the ethical and religious directives derived and written by the United States Council of Catholic Bishops. So the ACLU says we have the most dependent on Catholic hospitals in the nation. Our numbers are a little different from theirs because they didn't include critical access hospitals, which are rural safety net hospitals. But we are among the most reliant in the nation.
And some communities are really reliant on these hospitals. You focus in one case on a community in Milwaukee where this is their main road to hospital-style health care. They do provide a lot of valuable services people are counting on, it sounds like.
Right. These are safety nets in rural and urban communities alike. So even in Milwaukee, which has more hospitals than any other county, it's super saturated market. But the choice isn't there for a lot of communities on which hospital to go to. And you can see that in sort of the birth data. So at St. Joseph, it's an Ascension hospital. It's Catholic. It's located in a poor, predominantly Black neighborhood. And that shows in sort of the babies that are born there. More than 6 out of 10 babies born there are born to Black mothers, whereas 7 miles away at a secular hospital, Aurora West Allis, more than 6 out of 10 babies are born to white mothers. So it's the sort of city segregation is sort of reflected in which hospitals people go to, and it's often dependent on which community the hospital is located in.
And because these are Catholic institutions, they abide by a set of guidelines. I think it was 76 directives from U.S. Catholic bishops. We don't need to get into all 77, but can you talk about what that means for a hospital based on these guidelines?
Right. So much of the directives are related to reproductive care, so things like abortion, contraception, sterilization, and in vitro fertilization. They also prohibit physician-assisted suicide, but that's not legal in Wisconsin either. So really, a lot of it revolves around reproductive care. So in most ways, these Catholic hospitals are no different from secular hospitals, except in this sort of small corner. But it's an important corner of reproductive care around delivery and contraception and things of those nature.
And you talked to first of all, community members, community leaders who are concerned about those restrictions in care. What kind of concerns did they bring up about that?
Well, they think that they restrict access to important forms of care, but that it could exacerbate existing racial and socioeconomic disparities in healthcare access and healthcare outcomes. So St. Joseph specifically, because it's a lower income, predominantly Black neighborhood, they have those existing barriers to certain forms of care, contraceptive care, and health outcomes. Milwaukee has the highest infant mortality rate. It has a high Black mother mortality rate. So there's these existing things, and it's an added barrier to accessing these forms of care for groups that historically have had little access to this care.
And you talk to providers, you talk to the Catholic hospitals themselves, and it sounds like there's a lot of gray area, depending on which hospital you go to, which physician you might see, as to whether they provide care, refer you to something outside of the system. Talk about the landscape.
Right. That's a thing that really stuck out to me through weeks of reporting this story, which is just the lack of transparency and the variation among hospitals, even within the same health system. So you might have among Ascension Hospitals, which is the largest Catholic health system in the state and one of the largest nonprofit health systems in the nation. You might have one hospital that's super strict with the ERDs and interprets them and don't do tubal ligations, which is more commonly referred to having a woman's tubes tied. Whereas at another Ascension Hospital, they're doing these services and they're giving out IUDs, which are not typically given out at Catholic hospitals. Like at Ascension All Saints, they billed for IUDs 666 times last year, whereas at St. Joseph, they billed for it 15 times. So there's this, they largely don't provide these services, but there's variation. And as you say, it depends on which doctor you get. Maybe you get a doctor that agrees with the Catholic hospital's policies and won't advise you on where to get an abortion or where to get contraception, but you might get one that does.
And in one case, I don't have this right, they would refer to an affiliated provider, a secular provider whose main job was eye care, but to do those tubal ligations?
That's in Madison, yeah. So St. Mary's, SSM St. Mary's, it's a Catholic hospital. For a woman that wants an elective tubal ligation, so not after she delivers, they can send them to, or they do send them to, Davis Duerdien Eye Care, which is a clinic that does eye surgery. And the nurse that we talked to said the place isn't really set up for eye surgery. It's or for tubal ligation surgery. It's set up for eye surgery, and it doesn't sometimes have the equipment needed. So physicians will walk back and forth between the eye clinic and St. Mary's to get the needed equipment. And it's sort of an example of a loophole about how physicians are providing the services, but also a question of whether they're providing the best care possible.
Talking to Parker Shore from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and the Capital Times, looking at reporting on hospitals in Wisconsin, services that may not be available at some of them at Catholic institutions in the state. Parker, you talked to some physicians who pointed toward potentially life-threatening impacts for pregnant women going through a crisis. Can you talk about what you heard from them?
Right. So whereas contraception and sterilization is a common procedure, late pregnancy complications are relatively rare. They might only happen a handful of times at a hospital a year, but they do happen. And these physicians are saying that Catholic hospitals can prevent them from providing the best care possible and delay care until, one physician said, the last possible second. So Catholic hospitals will terminate a pregnancy if the woman's life is at risk. But where they draw that line is much further down the path than maybe a secular hospital would. So we talked with two physicians who had personal experiences of mothers having a late pregnancy complication where the fetus is not viable, it has no chance of survival, but they won't terminate until they showed, for instance, at St. Joseph in Milwaukee, until they showed demonstrable signs of infection, and then they would terminate. Whereas at a secular hospital, they're not going to wait until the mother shows infection to terminate if the mother desires that course of action.
Now, you reached out to some of the Catholic hospitals and their umbrella organizations. What kind of things did they say about concerns raised by doctors and community groups?
Well, we sent a survey to all the Catholic hospitals in the nation, sort of because there's such a lack of transparency around these things and variation. We really just wanted to know, what do you provide? What don't you provide? How do you interpret the directives? And no hospital responded individually. We got a response from the Catholic Health Association, which sort of provided a general response about Catholic health care. And their response is that they don't put the mother's life at risk, that they provide the same level of care, but even better standards of care than secular hospitals. They point to data that shows people actually recommend Catholic health care more than other types of healthcare. And that's true according to the data that they showed. So that's what they responded to by saying.
Parker, people can read more in your reporting over at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism website. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Parker Shore is a reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and a public policy fellow at the Capital Times. We talked to him about the center's report on reproductive care at Wisconsin's Catholic hospitals. Coming up, new research finds that bad dreams may have a positive impact on our waking life. We'll find out why coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a sleep researcher tells us why bad dreams may be good for us. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a talking tree.
For many people, Christmas in Green Bay is not complete without a visit to Bruce the Spruce. It's a fake tree that talks to visitors. Bruce was created by the H.C. Prangy department store chain and would startle shoppers back in the day when more people shopped at brick-and-mortar stores. Bruce's were in shops around Wisconsin, and one found his home in Green Bay at the Neville Public Museum. Spoiler alert for children who may be listening, Patty Murray caught up with Bruce and his wranglers, the volunteers inhabiting the tree.
The Pulaski High School Chamber Choir performs for museum visitors on a recent Saturday. They're set up near Bruce the Spruce, a talking Christmas tree. 10-year-old Emily Bushke came to visit Bruce with her father, Scott.
Our Christmas tree doesn't talk.
They spent part of their morning talking with Bruce and looking at its ornaments.
Emily, what was your favorite ornament?
The Bob Ross.
Bob Ross? And why do you like Bob Ross ornament?
He's an artist. I'm an artist.
For decades, kids have been visiting Bruce around the holidays. For many adults now, meeting with him is a kitschy treat. Lynette Green, yes, as in a green tree, is inhabiting Bruce this particular morning.
Bruce is a talking spruce, and I've been around since the early 1970s.
Legend has it that Bruce saved Christmas by waking up a sleepy Santa Claus.
Santa was taking a nap, and it was a really good nap. And then Bruce had to wake him up because Christmas was going to come. And if Santa wouldn't have woke up, well, goodness knows what would have happened. So actually, I am one of the big reasons that Christmas happened that year. So that's how I got a lot of my magic powers.
How did you wake him up?
Well, I just kind of leaned over and tickled him. I was kind of a wee sapling then, but I was like, Santa, Santa. And I had my little branches, and I moved him a little bit. And then he said, Bruce, oh my goodness, I would have slept right through Christmas. I'm so glad that you woke me up.
Why is something moving on the tree?
Because sometimes when I talk, my branches move.
The adult boring version is that one of the managers of Prangy's back in the early 70s had kind of seen this concept of a talking Christmas tree at another department store that was out of state.
That's Ryan Swadley, the museum's educator and Bruce Wrangler. Basically, he works with the tree's volunteers.
He brought the idea back to Green Bay and sort of fashioned his own tree that a person could be in and talk and interact with the public, and named it Bruce after his own son.
Here's the door. So it has obviously a window, but we lock it during the regular hours.
You don't want anybody, it's like Wizard of Oz. Pull back the curtain.
Kevin Cullen is the Neville's deputy director. He works with Swadley on the Bruce exhibit and the Enchanted Forest display, which includes vintage animatronic figures that bedeck the old downtown Prangy's windows. He says sometimes Bruce's were known to get rather randy.
Yeah, this is when they, you know, Prangy's were in department stores and malls throughout, you know, really Wisconsin, from Eau Claire, Sheboygan, here in Green Bay, up to Sturgeon Bay, and so on. Of course, when you're sitting in a tree kind of bored all day, and you start to kind of conjure up some interesting stories or scare some people. But yeah, I'm sure there were I know there was exchanges that happened with more about the public getting surprised and adults that were scared of a tree talking to them and didn't think it was too funny and exchanged some colorful language.
People have the opportunity to talk with Bruce the Spruce through the holiday season.
WPR's Patty Murray brought us that story on Bruce the Spruce in Green Bay. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, bad dreams are a part of our sleeping life, and while they may seem like a nuisance or feel disruptive, they actually might serve a greater purpose. According to new research, bad dreams may prime us to better handle fear while we're awake. Our next guest was part of the study and joins us to explain the findings. Amandine Vallemont is a sleep researcher with the Wisconsin Institute of Sleep and Consciousness Research in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison. Amandine, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Why did you and your colleagues want to tackle what happens when we're having bad and scary dreams?
So in general, we're interested at looking at sleep and dreams. But we also thought it's interesting to look at scary dreams because of the certain percentage of the population who suffer from that.
Well, and everybody has some kind of scary dream sometimes, I imagine. Not necessarily like a problem, but we all have it sometimes.
We all have it from time to time, and only maybe 1 to 7% of the population have recurrent nightmares, like more than once a week, which impair their daily life.
And what did you learn when you looked at what's happening to us while we're having bad dreams during the night or while we sleep versus what's going on when we're awake?
Well, the interesting thing is that we found out that the same brain structures respond to fearful situations during wake and also during sleep. So that was never shown before. Your same brain structures react to fearful situations.
And stepping away from the particular research for a moment, it's surprising to me sometimes how little we know about what's going on when we're sleeping and dreaming. There's still a lot of, I guess, mystery to solve.
Yes, and because it's complicated to assess. So the only way that we do that here is we wake up people several times during the night and try to ask whether they're dreaming or not, or what's happening.
And then how do you watch, say if I'm the research subject, how do you watch what's going on in my brain while I'm having that bad dream?
So we use electrodes, which are just stuck and put on top of your head. And we have many electrodes to be able to have a very fine localization of your neural activity.
And this sounds like complicated research to do, because one, if I had electrodes on my head, I'd have a hard time falling asleep. Mm-hmm. But two, you can't predict when somebody's going to have a bad dream, right? You have to keep trying until you get the right kind of dreams.
It's true, yeah. I think I'm not sure about the number of people that were in this study anymore, but of course not all of them had dreams and not all of them had fearful dreams. So
could it be that we're practicing while we're sleeping? We're rehearsing how we might deal with a real-life scary event?
Yep, so that's one of the current theory about dreaming, which was proposed in 2000 by Antti Revonzo, and it's called, it's basically this principle that dreams are here to help us rehearse fearful situations that we may encounter during waking life, and we rehearse like evasive actions or defensive actions during sleep.
So how do we evaluate then? How do we know if that scary dream we had last night made us more prepared for a threat in real life?
Yeah, well, that's what this paper was about. They showed fearful images to people in an MRI, and they saw that the people who had more fearful dreams in general would react less to these fearful images in wake life. So meaning they would be a little bit more prepared.
Now, so a scary dream makes me more prepared to deal with a scary image in real life. But is there a ceiling? Is there a point where where it's too scary when we're sleeping?
This was not shown here, but it's conceivable, that if it's really too scary, it could actually disturb your sleep and makes you more anxious during the day, that this could happen. Here we are talking more about fearful dreams, but not complete traumatic nightmares, which are something different.
Maybe a whole nother problem. Yeah. Is there a growing body of research that compares and contrasts our state in our dreams, our emotional state in our dreams, with our emotional state in non-dreaming life?
There's some people who think that dreaming helps you regulate your emotions during the day. So if you have some issues, some problems overnight, your brain will work them out, and the next day you will have a better mood. So that's another theory about dreams.
Interesting. Yeah. So based on your research, should we welcome scary dreams, not feel bad about having them?
Based on this research, yes, that would be the conclusion.
But then the next step, we don't know of any way to make ourselves have a scary dream, right? Or do we? I don't know.
No, we don't. There are some cues about how to make you have lucid dreaming, so like knowing that you're dreaming while dreaming, but I don't know if there's a way to make you specifically have bad dreams.
What's the next research you're looking at when it comes to how we dream and what we might get out of it?
Well, I could tell you a word or two about my research, which is about people who act out their dreams. So normally when you're dreaming, you're in bed, you don't move, you're immobile. But I'm looking at people who have a disorder, and they start to punch or move their arms and even walk outside of their bed because they are thinking about, they are having a dream and they are doing that in their dream and also in real life. So it's like sleepwalking and this other disorder, REM behavior disorder. So I'm studying that because it's so fascinating, but why parts of their brain are still sleeping, but obviously parts of their brain must be awake and doing that.
And I think we've all known somebody, like my brother used to sleepwalk, but it sounds like we may not know that much about exactly why it might happen, say, to my brother and not to me.
Yes, yeah. There's a variety of factors from the genetics to the situation, being more sleep deprived, tired. Alcohol or medication might be trigger to these episodes. So in my lab, we invite people who have this regularly, and we actually sleep deprive them for one night. So then the next day they go to sleep, they are much more tired, and they are more likely to have these episodes that I'm trying to study.
Interesting. So the sleepier we are, the more we're prone to thrash or punch or maybe walk in our sleep?
Yeah, it's paradoxical, but that's what we found. Increasing, being extra tired. And at the same time, environmental factors, like maybe some noise in the environment, you might hear it while you're sleeping, and it doesn't completely wake you up, but it make you do this sleepwalking or sleep talking or punching your arms.
Oh, that's really interesting. I'm looking forward to see how that research comes out. Mm-hmm. Amandine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Amandine Vallemont is a sleep researcher with the Wisconsin Institute of Sleep and Consciousness Research in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about how bad dreams may help us handle and control fear while we're awake. Coming up, we'll talk with a lawyer about why he says the impeachment push against President Trump undermines the Constitution. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, if you want to invest some money but you don't know where to start, Kate Archer Kent's guest has some advice for you. Get an intro to the basics of the investing world and call in with your questions tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi continues to hang on to the articles of impeachment against President Trump. She says she's waiting to see what the trial in the Senate would look like before appointing managers and sending charges over there. The impasse is likely to stretch into the new year as the House is on a 2-week holiday break. Meanwhile, after House Democrats voted to impeach Trump last week, the Trump administration is reportedly preparing to say that he can't be considered to be formally impeached until Pelosi advances the articles. Despite the uncertainty, our guest says one thing is for sure, the impeachment effort subverts the Constitution. David Rifkin is a constitutional lawyer in Washington, D.C. He served at the Justice Department and the White House Counsel's Office during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. He's co-written opinion pieces on the current impeachment effort in the Wall Street Journal. David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Well, there's a lot of twists and turns from day to day, but big picture, why do you say the impeachment push is effectively illegitimate?
Well, what I've written about is that the substance of the articles of impeachment does not rise to the level of high crime and misdemeanor. I believe that the president cannot possibly commit high crime and misdemeanor while discharging the core constitutional powers of his office. Whether you like or dislike his phone call with Zelensky, he was squarely within his right as president to direct American foreign policy. That entails talking to the recipients of American foreign aid. in a situation where you believe there may have been instances of past corruption that need to be looked at or cured to ensure that no similar activities occur in the future. In fact, it really happens at the presidential level, but believe me, there's government officials at the ambassadorial level, Secretary of State level, sometimes law enforcement level, director of FBI, travels, visits his foreign counterparts, talks all the time about corruption. In fact, I think the Secretary of State for Political Affairs just visited Lebanon a couple of days ago, and the corruption within the Lebanese political establishment was very prominently featured in the discussions and in the press releases.
The argument has been, especially from House Democrats, that it isn't the push toward corruption to stop corruption they're worried about, but the appearance that the president had wanted foreign leaders to investigate the political opponent is likely or a likely political opponent in the 2020 elections, that it wasn't the business of the United States he was advocating for, but for his own. That's why at least the House leaders have said they've pursued impeachment.
Yeah, I think it's a specious argument. Yes, their argument is, if you look at the report prepared by the House Judiciary Committee's majority staff, they're saying that the president can commit high crime and misdemeanor even if what he is doing is otherwise legal because he's acting for corrupt motives. I think this argument is constitutionally untenable. To enable the House to inquire into the president's motives, then facially, clearly, what he is doing is meant to address a perfectly legitimate issue of foreign policy, to me, is completely untenable. And moreover, I mean, my secondary argument is, how do we know that he did not have a non-corrupt motive? Is it possible that he had a raison d'etat-based motive, but also a political motive? Look, as I mentioned in my op-ed, virtually everything that presidents do in our democracy, or leaders do in any democratic body polity, has some political dimension. Let me ask you this. If Trump were to call, let's say a transcript emerged, completely didn't happen to the best of my knowledge, but imagine this, that Trump called President Xi of China and said to him, look, elections are coming. I really would like you to give me a good trade deal. Okay? It clearly would advantage U.S. national interests, right? We want to have better trade relations with China, but don't steal our intellectual property, but it also have a political dimension. What about a deal with North Korea to denuclearize that country? Would it not have a political dimension? I think of any foreign policy issue, there's not a political dimension. So what? The president is not supposed to discharge his constitutional functions because it may have a political dimension? That's absurd.
Now, are you worried that, as the president has suggested, this would cheapen impeachment for future presidents?
Yes, I do. In fact, my primary interest is what it does to the separation of powers. Look, the framers debated, they were not super excited, contrary to what a lot of people may believe now, about the impeachment power. They understood that it is capable of overriding the democratic choice because we are a constitutional republic, but we're still a democracy. And it also, there's a real concern that would make the president a ward of Congress. I'm always paraphrasing the way the framers put it. They rejected the language that would have allowed impeachment for maladministration, believing that it's infinitely capacious. We have basically Democrats impeaching the president for maladministration because they think either what he asked of Ukraine was not worthy of being asked, or he asked it for the wrong reason. That completely distorts the separation of powers, weakens the presidency at the expense of Congress, and frankly sets a horrible precedent for the future. So this is well beyond issues of fairness to Trump as this current sitting president. I mean, that's real too, but my primary concern is about what it does to the separation of powers.
Talking to David Rifkin, constitutional lawyer in Washington, D.C. He served at the Justice Department and the White House Counsel's Office during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. We're talking about the current impeachment effort. He's been writing pieces in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere saying that this isn't what impeachment is for, that this current effort subverts the Constitution. Ultimately, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Getting into the day by day, David, now, what do you make of this decision by the House, by Speaker Pelosi, to hold on to the articles of impeachment, at least for now, saying, hey, let's see if the Senate is going to deal with this fairly.
And never, unfortunately, I'll leave a political dimension out of it. From a constitutional perspective, it's extremely unfortunate. Look, the Constitution divides the impeachment power between the House and the Senate. And that was important to the framers because they expected the Senate to act as a cooling saucer to the more populist House. The impeachment is completed in the House. It was up to the House to determine what procedures they would follow with impeachment. It's up to the Senate to determine what procedures they're going to follow with impeachment trial. Speaker Pelosi has absolutely no basis, no standing at all, to insist on any particular procedures in the Senate anymore. I mean, she can criticize, of course, what the Senate is going to do, but she has no right to insist on it, just like the Senate could and did criticize. There was a resolution by a Republican caucus in the Senate criticizing the House procedures, but the Senate did not tell the House, you have to do it this way or else. That's point number one. Point number two, the impeachment is complete. I disagree with those who say that it has not taken place. The jurisdiction now has passed to the Senate. The Senate has a constitutional duty to conduct an impeachment trial. It's very important. This is not like legislation that comes from a House where the Senate can sit on. Now, the Senate can be collegial vis-a-vis the House, can give them some reasonable time, a few days, maybe a couple weeks, to appoint the managers and send the articles over. But if it does not happen, the Senate, in my opinion, has a constitutional, not just a constitutional right, but a constitutional duty to proceed with the impeachment trial on its own. And frankly, it can do it without House managers. If House managers don't show up, it basically means that the House forfeits its case. Okay? Just like with any prosecution. Impeachment is similar to an indictment. I mean, think about it. If you're being charged with something, and you get to court, and the prosecutor doesn't show up, and the prosecutor has the burden of production and persuasion, the prosecutor loses. So she would forfeit her case. But she cannot possibly prevent the Senate from holding the trial.
I want to give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell talking about this issue and the withholding, for now at least, of the articles of impeachment. This is him speaking on Thursday.
Some House Democrats imply they're withholding the articles or some kind of leverage so they can dictate the Senate process to senators. I admit, I'm not sure what leverage there is in refraining from sending us something we do not want. But alas, if they can figure that out, they can explain it. Meanwhile, other House Democrats seem to be suggesting they'd prefer never to transmit the articles. Fine with me.
As you mentioned, you don't want to get into the politics here, but is part of the problem we have when we're trying to do impeachment that the Constitution doesn't give a lot of detail, and B, we don't have a lot of precedent from past examples?
The Constitution does not provide a lot of details, but the Constitution provides sufficient guidance. The Constitution says clearly that the power of impeachment is in the House. The power to conduct the impeachment trial is in the Senate. That is all the guidance that one needs. The House has completed the impeachment process. By the way, there are people who are arguing, for example, that, well, the impeachment is not really complete until the articles are sent to the House. The reason I find this argument to be implausible is because the impeachment power is lacking what is called the presentment clause. If you listen to this, presentment clause is a language of the Constitution that in the legislative context requires the legislation to be sent to the president, right? So the president can exercise, can either acquiesce or exercise his veto power, which can be overridden depending on the political balance. There's no presentment clause in the impeachment context. So the impeachment is complete at the time the House votes on the articles of impeachment. And they did. And they told the world the president is impeached. They cannot pause this, okay? The Senate has a constitutional duty to conduct an impeachment trial. To basically countenance what Speaker Pelosi is doing would mean that the House can effectively sabotage, going forward, the constitutional duty that's allocated to the Senate. It can conduct an impeachment and just sit on it. That cannot be true.
We're talking about the impeachment effort against President Trump. Our guest says it undermines the Constitution. David Rivkin is a constitutional lawyer who served at the Justice Department and White House Counsel's Office under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Democrats are using impeachment as a political weapon? Is President Trump getting a fair shake? Do you think that impeachment is the appropriate tool in this situation? What do you think of the Speaker Pelosi's decision to not pass these articles of impeachment on, at least not yet, to the Senate? And finally, what are you looking for in a Senate impeachment trial? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation on the impeachment efforts against President Trump. Constitutional lawyer David Rivkin is with us. He served at the Justice Department and White House Counsel's Office during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. He's co-written opinion pieces on President Trump's impeachment in The Wall Street Journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the impeachment proceedings. Do you think, are you glad that the House voted to impeach? What do you want to see out of the Senate? Do you agree with our guest that this is not a legitimate process ultimately? You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go right to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Bayfield. Jeff, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, I think that David kind of presented an inaccurate argument early when he was talking about, it'd be kind of like if Trump set up a deal with China, a trade deal with China, or if Trump set up a nuclear deal with North Korea. And in both of those cases, I would think that anybody on either side of the aisle would say those are things that, if done the right way, could be for the common good. But what we had in this situation, David, was we had a president who had a deal worked out with Ukraine for the defense of Ukraine from the second or maybe third biggest military power in the world right now, and he was withholding that deal. He was withholding that deal. He was not creating a deal at this point. He was not the deal maker, no art of the deal, and he was doing so to start an investigation in something that was debunked and really had no merit. If David, if you could maybe find some people that say, oh yeah, there's clearly something for the common good regarding the Bidens in Ukraine, to start an investigation into them. But
Jeff, thanks for the call. I want to bring David. David, what do you think?
Let me say briefly, look, you may well disagree with the proposition that was worth investigating past allegedly corrupt episodes in Ukraine history. And I say allegedly because they've not been proven. You may disagree using military aid as leverage, but let me assure you, it happens every day that the recipients of U.S. aid are pushed on a variety of issues to obtain policy outcomes. Nothing unique about it with Trump. Again, mentioned Lebanon earlier. We are articulated public. They're going to withhold considerable aid we give to the Lebanese armed forces, okay? And it's important to us because Lebanese armed forces, sort of the only one of a few remaining non-sectarian institutions in Lebanon. And we have issues with Hezbollah and Iran. So it's very much in our interest to give aid to Lebanese armed forces. We're going to withhold it unless the Lebanese state addresses rampant corruption in Lebanon. Okay, now you'd say to me, well, there is corruption in Lebanon. Nobody disagrees with it. There is no corruption in Ukraine. But that's your opinion. You may be right. You may be wrong. But you cannot possibly impeach the president for doing something that, in his opinion, and on its face, is a perfectly legitimate exertion of legislative power. Otherwise, why for example, I very much oppose something called JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran. I thought it was utterly wrong, utterly inconsistent with our national security interests. I never suggested that President Obama should be impeached for it. I mean, there are all sorts of things the president is doing foreign affairs that people disagree with, or members of Congress disagree with. Cannot possibly be a basis for an impeachable offense, because if it is, we're back to maladministration. And maladministration, that 18th century parlance, was precisely what the caller describes, which is the president doing something that somebody else in Congress disagrees with. Does not think it's good administration, thinks it's maladministration. Cannot be true. Framers rejected that, because that would make the president a ward of Congress.
Jeff, thanks for that call. Talking to David Rivkin about the latest on impeachment. Back to your calls. Mike is with us in Edgerton. Mike, hi. Are you there, Mike?
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
I'm here. My problem is during the hearings, the Republicans, instead of trying to ramrod the procedures and basically going off the end on issues surrounding the hearing, why didn't they ask some of these questions and put forth whatever evidence they had instead of trying to append the process through procedures?
Mike, thanks for the call. I feel like I got to sit here and listen to a lot of these. Mike's right that the Republicans did talk about procedures a lot. It did seem like they challenged the substance of the accusations involved in these articles of impeachment. David?
Frankly speaking, in my opinion, I hate to sound snarky, they did not do a glorious job. If it were up to me, I would have argued first and foremost that those types of charges inherently, as a matter of law, cannot amount to high crime and misdemeanors, and the details are almost irrelevant, okay? Now, that's me. I'm not the House of Representatives. Now, they had perfectly legitimate gripes about procedures. I would say that the House Democrats used procedures that were far less fair than the case with either the President Clinton impeachment or the way the House of Representatives approached the Nixon situation. Remember, Nixon resigned before the impeachment was complete, or if you look at the late earliest example of the impeachment of Andrew Johnson during the Reconstruction period following Civil War. But to me, again, procedures be darned. To me, the fundamental problem here is the House is trying to impeach the president for something that cannot conceivably, under any set of facts, amount to high crime and misdemeanors. And one other point, I think listeners should appreciate, that they're really impeaching the president because, leaving aside the partisanship, let me give it a most charitable explanation. They disagree with his foreign policy. I already made the point about maladministration. And you know how we know that? Every single witness they called expressed their considered judgment, and all foreign policy professionals, about what should have been the U.S. foreign policy towards Ukraine. That the interest of prompt dispensation of military aid, let's forget whether or not it was withheld for how long, but prompt dispensation of military aid, an opinion of people from the NSC, from the State Department, was so important that it brooked no delay. Only one problem. Their opinion does not matter at all. The only opinion that matters in this issue is the president's. Okay, because it's his discretion. He is the head of the executive branch. He decides. When President Obama was in office, he decided. Now President Trump decides. It doesn't matter what a bunch of foreign policy professionals, frankly, or members of Congress think. It ain't their decision.
Time for one more caller. Judy is with us in Appleton. Judy, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm calling because I'm so upset listening to people who are trying to make arguments that Nancy Pelosi is withholding the articles of impeachment from the Senate without any, basically holding it hostage. That's not true. It's a procedure. She is following procedure. She told that to everyone on national television. Why don't people understand that? And it's the same procedure that was set up when Clinton was impeached. And that's all I've got to say. I'm just very angry. I think the president does need to be impeached.
Judy, thanks for the call. David, just 30 seconds left or so for you to tackle that.
It's not true. She has basically indicated, and I don't think it would last, frankly, that she's going to indefinitely withhold the articles of impeachment. Following every other impeachment, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, the articles of impeachment went to the Senate in short order, and the impeachment manager was selected by the House. That's not what's happening here. She has absolutely no right to insist on any particular Senate procedures, any more than the Senate had a constitutional right to insist on any particular House procedures. I don't remember the Senate. I know individual members of the Senate criticized the secrecy of Intelligence Committee hearings, but this were just statements of policy. No, she's completely out of line. This whole thing is, not to use too strong of a word, in my opinion, is an abomination from a constitutional perspective, whether you like President Trump or not.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure.
David Rifkin is a constitutional lawyer in Washington, D.C. He served at the Justice Department and the White House Counsel's Office during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. We talked with him about President Trump's impeachment and why he says the effort subverts the Constitution. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a Wisconsin Lutheran pastor shares his experiences in Birmingham, Alabama, in the middle of civil rights progress and tragedy, and in his decades serving communities in Milwaukee. And we'll find out how U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt changed the shape of American athletics and physical fitness. You may have him to thank for gym class. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, there's been a big push in recent years for character education. But what does that mean? Kate's guest tells us how we can teach, judge, and build character. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then you can harness the power of your mind to make your job and your career better and more fulfilling. We'll meet the author of the book, Take Your Brain to Work. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.